Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
John, headline, America, what went wrong? The crisis deepens. This is a serious topic, John Krofcik. I'm Larry Rifkin, and I'll tell you, long before COVID-19 ravaged the economy, we had a lot of problems, John.
We certainly did.
Whitewash it.
No.
We had millions of middle-class people struggling with stagnant earnings, unaffordable health care, and an impoverished retirement looming. And those problems have only gotten worse for many.
Oh, yeah. Many people have lost jobs. I mean, you know, lost their homes. I mean, you think about what happened to a lot of people right now.
And before this, many people were in trouble. How many times have we read about somebody who couldn't afford if they needed $400 for an emergency repair?
Right.
It was beyond their reach.
Yeah.
And for many of us, that's hard to imagine.
It's terrible.
But it is the reality. So the downward spiral of America's middle class is no accident. That's the point of our conversation today. It's all baked into policies that we have been undertaking for about 40 years now here in America, which has brought us more inequality than we've ever had. And John, it's fascinating. There was a book that was done many years ago. We'll talk about the context and the time frame. And it was done by these two Pulitzer Prize winning reporters, Donald Barlett and James Steele. And they decided that even though they wrote this book a long time back, not even in this century, that it was really worth updating, because what they found at that time that was beginning to occur in the latter part of the 20th century had only escalated and gotten worse.
Wow.
At the beginning of the 21st century. So they went out and they updated, John. Now, take a look at the book. It's right here, and John and I are looking at it. But, John, they've got more graphs and charts. I mean, the information, there are many books that I donate to the library, as you know, John.
Yes,
they almost have a wing of our library in our town to me. But I am I'm going to keep this book because it's fascinating. And what they do,
you can pass it on to your kids for the next century.
For the next century, I could. But they talk about bankruptcies rising, jobs disappearing. Yeah. And if they've got a report on something that's going on, for example, employees losing benefits, some creditors receiving pennies on the dollar for their claims in bankruptcy court, they do an update. So they've got the original text of the book. Then they update it.
Wow.
To make certain that it is really in tune with what's going on today. For example, they've got a chapter, fewer workers have guaranteed pensions, John. Now, you and I know this.
Yes.
And they make certain to update where that has gone. And it's only gotten worse over the years.
It's self-retirement now. Now, forget it.
And then the gender gap in retirement income. They lay out women and men, and they update that information. But throughout the book, with really interesting charts and graphs, they're able to give us an updated look at how these policies, which have been, in their minds, intentional.
That's pretty amazing. We're looking back to look forward.
Exactly, John.
Wow.
Through the looking glass, like Alice in Wonderland. Well, a very important book, a very important topic. America, what went wrong? We're going to dissect that today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is just a remarkable journalist. His name is James Steele, and he and his partner, Donald Barlett, years ago did this incredible book called America, What Went Wrong? And now they've updated it because the crisis seems to be deepening in the United States. And I want to go back to the original premise of the book, looking back to a lot of things that have occurred over the last 40 years, you saw a trend in our country that made people, well, less comfortable, perhaps less sense of certainty about their lives, more adrift, more afloat in a very competitive environment, and with less governmental protections than they might have assumed that they had at that moment in time.
That's an excellent summary of the original book. And I really want to compliment you on that because the book was in fact, it was ahead of its time in that sense. And any number of reviewers and observers made that point. Not to us, we just laid it out there. Because we hit those things, it was also a controversial book. It was a very popular book. And people saw in their own lives a lot of the stories of the people we wrote about in the book, in terms of what happened to their jobs, in terms of what had happened to their benefits. The other thing the book warned about, which was quite controversial at the time, we said unless we change our policies, direction in this country, we're going to have increasing income inequality. That was criticized at the time, and the Wall Street Journal actually, in their lead editorial one day, attacked us for making such statements. But anyway, as we've known since then, sadly, that has come true, and it's reached far greater dimensions than we had even forecast back in the early 1990s. So the book said the middle class is threatened, and it's threatened by specific actions of Washington and Wall Street, where we're taking away or eroding the economic underpinnings that were so important to the middle class, what they earned, what their benefits were, what their securities were in retirement. All of those things were under siege. And as you just pointed out so well, every one of those problems has intensified greatly over the last 30 years, which is why, as much as anything, we decided to go back and revisit this. The stories in the book are sort of the people, what happened to them. Some of these go back a number of years. But frankly, they're timeless because the same kinds of things are continuing to go on, where companies take over an established entity, put people out to pasture. The people who had good jobs suddenly have mediocre jobs and no benefits. All the things we wrote about that were just really starting then have intensified and just gotten a lot worse. So that's what drew us back to the subject and why we felt we needed to not just update it, but also to bring this to the attention of, frankly, a younger generation who may not really know how long this has been going on and how embedded these policies are and how much they need to be changed.
They do seem rather intractable when you read your book, and it doesn't matter whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration. It seems to go on unimpeded. Now, I just want my listeners to understand that we're going back to 1992 for the original construct of this book, and now it's been updated to the point where the pandemic is considered as a part of what will be an ongoing rush of activity that may have a greater impact on some of the trends that we have seen. And just so you understand, those listening, Mr. Barlett and Mr. Steele are two of the most honored investigative reporters in America. They've received two Pulitzer Prizes, two National Magazine Awards, and really they have been awarded so many honors in their field. They are remarkable. And when you go into this book, I just want my listeners to understand, you're going to get detailed charts and graphs. So if you're a person who cares about empirical data to support a good argument, this is a really important book. And I want to start off perhaps deeper into the book, but I want to go to this because I think it's so important. You basically tell us that tax policy in America, and very few people question it to the degree that they should. And every time we hear something like tax reform, and it's a term often used, it generally results in worse conditions for most Americans, and yet it's lauded as a reform.
Yes. Long ago, the folks who wanted to take care of everybody at the top figured out, put the words tax reform on tax legislation, and you can get anything through Congress. Usually there's a stop or two in there for the middle class and for people coming up from the bottom, but basically most of the tax legislation over, with a couple of exceptions, over the last really 30 to 40 years has been it's just been aimed toward the elite. I mean, look at the Trump tax bill. Trump, when the bill was being considered, he said no wealthy person is going to benefit from this bill at all. Well, once this bill was complete, and by the way, I should stress that this was only in the tradition, which we've been doing now in this country for decades, but when the bill was done and the ink was dry, what did you have? Everybody making a million or more got a $64,000 a year tax cut. If you were making $50,000 to $75,000 a year, the heart of the middle class, what did you get? Well, you've got $800 a year. That's not my definition of how we need to help the middle class in this country. I mean, we had in that bill, which we've had in so many other bills, is money was sent to people who don't need any more money. And that's why we've ended up with this dreadful income inequality situation in this country. I mean, we make the point in the book. A lot of people will say, well, inequalities, there's a lot of things, more training, more education is needed for people, this, that, and the other thing. All of that, I don't disagree with. But the single greatest driver of income inequality is the tax code. The way we have just systematically rewarded those at the top who don't need the money and not rewarded people in the middle and below who desperately need that, as we found out so dramatically with COVID-19 and many of the protests that have rocked American cities.
And this is not inadvertent. I mean, you talk about the lobbyists and the special interests. And why is it that every Congress doesn't go about, particularly when you have, say, a House of Representatives now under the control of the Democrats, why don't they make a real cause celeb about a restructuring? I mean, in the past, as you point out, we had a 70% tax rate on the highest earners in America. Now I believe it's 37%. You talk about the estate tax and the fact that it virtually touches no one any longer. I mean, the estates have to be so uber and so mega for it to apply. So why have we allowed this to go on for so long, both parties?
Well, I think it's certainly been more on the Republican side than the Democratic side. And I mean, that's one thing you see out there in general. But even in the Democrats, there hasn't been the real willingness to take on this issue the way that there should be. Certainly in the campaign, some of the candidates, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, zeroed in on this in what I thought was a proper way. They understood exactly the imbalance out there. But the party as a whole hasn't embraced this yet. On the Republican side, you just see people who are committed to as little government as possible. And their concept of little government means low taxes. The whole guiding principle on the other side of the aisle for Republicans for decades has been, let us keep our money and we will decide what's best for America the way we will spend it. Our own personal foundations, or this or that or the other thing. They do not believe, many of them, in the common good in that sense. And that's why we have this terrible situation. You look at the tax proposal, I try to stay out of politics and just try to look at things as close to what would be really happening if somebody got elected. And I have to say that Vice President Biden's tax policies are much more vigorous than we've seen in the past out of a lot of Democratic administrations. He particularly wants to raise the corporate tax rate back to where something near where it should be. You know, that was one of the other outrageous things that they did in the 2017 bill. They lowered the corporate tax rate to 21%. And you were talking about the individual income taxes, how they were once 70%. Not so many decades ago, corporations paid almost 40% of the total income tax bill. That's both individuals and corporations. You know what's going to be this year? Even before COVID-19, less than 10%. So, I mean, they use the air, they use the highways, they use the various facilities of the United States of America, why should they get this dramatic reduction overall in their tax rate while we have all of these needs out there?
Well, you also have in the book lists of companies like IBM, Amazon, Netflix, paying nothing, zero, to the federal government. And that we've heard time and again, and we just can't believe that there isn't at least a minimum threshold. You talk about 40 years of government retreating. And there was a time, and I can remember it, given my age, when we really thought government had a role in our lives that was salubrious. I remember, of course, and we've all gotten excited about what Elon Musk and the NASA folks did recently, when we said, wow, the possibilities that America has are endless, and we entrust to our government the ability to get many of these things done and to lead us in science and technology and the like. When did it go off the rails where we began to believe that the private sector was so much better equipped to handle many things, even though, as you show in the book, they have retreated from some of their social obligations to pensions and the like? Why did we feel we could entrust them with what many consider in other countries to be the public sector's responsibility?
Larry, this is a great question, and it goes really to the heart, in many ways, of our book, and to the heart of what we need in this country. You can't pin it on any one particular date, but starting in the 70s, a lot of very conservative think tanks began to spew out various papers about there was too much government regulation, that the government was too much in our lives, that there were less government, the full promise of America would be there on display for everybody. So these ideas began to sort of be sown in the 70s. In the late 70s, you had trucking deregulation, which was one of the very first examples of the result of that. Airline deregulation came along shortly thereafter. You'll get debates to this day about that. But one thing you know for sure, both of those acts were extremely detrimental to working people who worked for those two industries. And then after that, of course, we had the SNL deregulation. And we all know about the Great Recession of 2008, which was banking and financial deregulation. I mean, that was one of the things that were part of it. So all of it begins back there. And then you've got the famous quote from Ronald Reagan about what are the nine worst words in the English language? I'm from the government. I'm here to help. I mean, you can't underestimate how that sort of poisoned the well. And everybody started believing, well, that's true. Let's cut red tape. Let's do this. The red tape that was cut that led to the Great Recession of 2008 was catastrophic. And I still do not think the average Americans fully realize how much deregulation was at the root of that. The one thing that the conservatives put out was you had all of these people buying houses who shouldn't have bought houses. Well, one of the reasons some of them bought houses is because the whole thing had been deregulated so much that it was in the interest of those generating those mortgages and those acquisitions to just sell them without any consequences. They decoupled from who was loaning the money, like a bank or an SNL, to who was receiving the money. And that's one of the reasons we had that catastrophe. But that was deregulation. Anyway, so that's, I think, where things began. And one of the big points that we make in this book, and this is a different point than we made back in the original book, because we think the crisis is graver. The crisis is much more severe now. We need to get back to what you just were talking about. We need to get back to the realization that there is a significant role for government, and it can be a very positive one. And we cite over the years, over the century, any number of times where things were very, very severe and harming people, both in terms of their health and their financial health, where the government stepped up, Congress stepped up, passed legislation that attempted to rectify a problem and did a pretty good job of it in many cases. And that's what we need now. We need a massive focus on what do we need to do to help working Americans in the middle class. And we can get in that in a minute if you want.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Ben Steele is explaining the elements that went into this incredible book called America, What Went Wrong? The Crisis Deepens, an updated version of 30 years on. And I've got to start here because we are at a point where the government really has stepped in pretty dramatically during this coronavirus episode that we are going through. And they have tried to backstop, underpin, whatever we want to call it, the economy and the Federal Reserve being really outsized in its role. But Jim Cramer from CNBC recently said, coronavirus is the largest transfer of wealth ever. Now, what is he saying, that we're getting more inequity? Because in your book, you go back to 1959 and you say you have the top 4%, then the bottom 35, and now the spread has been so much greater between those top earners and the poor. So what are we looking at even before the coronavirus and now subsequent, or at least somewhere in the middle of it?
Well, in terms of the transfer of wealth, I'm glad you brought that whole issue up, because we went back and looked at this whole thing over time. When we have a chart in the new book that talks about the top 4%. We also talk about the 1% as well, but we take the top 4%. If you go back to 1959, 1960, the top 4% in the U.S. earned as much as the bottom 35%. By the time we wrote the original book back in 1992, the top 4%, one of the things a numbers guy like me is always careful of is to make sure he's reading the right numbers.
That's okay. That's
because these are all complicated.
But anyway, I like truth. I like fact. I mean, I hear okay. So little of it today.
And I'll talk to you a second about some of these numbers after I tell you. But anyway, so back in 59, 1960, the top 4% earned as much as the bottom 35%. Now, what that means is that there's an awful lot of people in the middle who are benefiting from the American dream, the American middle class, and so forth. Well, by 1989, after a decade of buccaneering and Wall Street running amok, that had changed rather dramatically. The top 4% then earned as much as the bottom 51%. So already you're seeing a pretty dramatic shift toward the top. In 2017, and this is before the Trump tax bill, because now this numbers would be a lot worse, the top 4% earned as much as the bottom 57%. I would gather after 2017 that number is probably going to be close to 60%. So this is what we're doing. We've created massive income inequality, and largely because of the tax code. And it doesn't make any sense to put money into the hands of people who already have plenty. And everything we talk about on raising rates for the individuals, raising rates for the corporation, would not affect the lifestyle of one wealthy American family. These would be modest increases. In fact, some people might even argue they should be greater. Let me tell you one thing about the numbers we use in the book, if I could, without...
Sure.
A lot of people who study these issues rely on foundations, external studies, things of that sort. And while we have a couple of those that we mention and credit in the book, the numbers that you see where we talk about corporate taxes, individual taxes, median family income, all of those kinds of things are numbers that we have derived from the Internal Revenue Service, Bureau of Economic Analysis, the Census Bureau. We do our own economic analysis, is what I'm trying to say. We're not depending on somebody else to say, okay, this is what the situation is. And that's why we feel so strongly about this issue. When you look at some of these numbers, I mean, when I ran the numbers on the Trump tax bill about who was getting money at the top, that number was so big, we ran those numbers 3 or 4 times.
We couldn't believe it
the first time. I said, well, this can't be right. But there it is. Now, you won't see that number in the Joint Committee on Taxation report on this, but you will see the table, and from that table, you can easily extrapolate that number. It's just right there for anybody to see. So it's not a secret number. It's right there. And all we're doing is telling people, okay, this is the way it works out.
When you look at the insecurity that so many people feel, and they're not at the bottom necessarily, they're aspiring to get into the middle and stay in the middle. And I want to understand better how you interpret what middle class is, because we bandy that term around all the time.
Yes.
We say
yes.
That's what people aspire to do what it was that the parents and grandparents were able to do in America. And now we hear, instead of rags to riches, it's looking more like rags to rags and riches to riches. It's just not.
Yeah, I'm not laughing, but you're fortunately put your finger right on that. When we talk about middle class, we're just talking about it from an economic standpoint, a financial standpoint. A lot of people talk about themselves as being middle class, but they earn way too much money. I mean, they're clearly in the upper reaches of the economy in that sense. They're not one percenters by any means, but they're way above middle class. When we talk about middle class in this book and in the one prior to this, back in 1992, we described middle class as people earning from 20 to 50,000. Now, what we've done for this book is we've just adjusted those numbers for inflation, and they basically work out to 40,000 to 100,000 financially is the heart of the middle class. Now, in an expensive place like New York City, you'd have to say those numbers are bigger than that. The 40 to 100 is just a national level. But similarly, if you go out into the middle of Missouri or Kansas, small towns there, 40 to 100 would be much larger than what the average middle class would be in a place like that. So that's just something to kind of keep in mind. It's a national figure based on the average of all the tax returns, and that's how we came up with that. Obviously, 40,000 in the middle of Missouri or Illinois is not a bad income for people, and you can live off that. And but obviously, in New York City, you're probably a poverty's door. So that's the background on what.
And by the way, folks, there are some wonderful stories, people you will meet, so that you can really see in an illustrative sense what we're talking about here. And you've got stories about people whose lives converge in ways that they never expected as you studied the decline that's been going on in America. But I want to point to something that you talk about a good bit, that I don't think a lot of people really understand. And it's not that anybody wants to beat down the business community in America, but I think people are looking for equity and fairness for individuals as well who are struggling under the weight of a lot of debt. And new to the book and the times, of course, is all the higher education debt that you point out, and the fact
yes.
that these private companies who we have become so much more reliant upon for our security going forward into retirement, have also pulled back on pensions, and the pensions have been under great assault financially, and they're not even available in most private companies these days. But you point out something, and explain it to us, because you spend a lot of time on it, so it's got to be very important, that the government permits virtually unlimited tax deductions for interest on debt. Now, that might seem a bit arcane, but I know you can really explain it to us and why you spent a good bit of time on that.
It's one of the, again, I'm so glad you asked that, because that's one of these hidden things people are not really aware of. This is one of the ways that corporations dramatically reduce their taxes. What happens is, if you're a corporation, if you borrow money to take over another company or build a plant in Pakistan or wherever it is, you can borrow money, and the interest on the borrowed money is deductible from your corporate tax return. Now, the Trump tax bill nicked that benefit a little bit for the first time, but it was pretty inconsequential and completely offset by the fact that they lowered the overall corporate rate down to 21% from 35%. So it was a wash in that sense. But this has been a powerful tool for the private equity and the hedge funders, because you look at so many of the companies they've taken over in recent years, which have really collapsed. Payless Shoes is one. Toys R Us, the very famous toy merchandise company. Mm-hmm. Here, money is borrowed by somebody, one of these Wall Street equity companies or hedge funds. They take over the established company, largely using this borrowed money, the interest on it, which, of course, they write off. So the tax code makes that a lot easier. They cut down the size of the workforce, maybe close a few stores here and there. In the case of Payless Shoes, which was this kind of working class shoe store that you found in shopping malls mm-hmm. all over America, they made so many mistakes on this, and the debt was so high, they ended up having to close the entire company. So a company that had thousands of stores, thousands of employees, now doesn't have one store in America. And that story is repeated over and over again from the private equity. But what drives that whole process is largely the fact that they can deduct the interest on the debt that they borrow to do this. So they don't even use their own money to create this mayhem. And we, the taxpayers, subsidize the process by lowering their tax return down the line. So, yeah, this is a huge debt. I mean, sorry, it's a huge deduction. It's kind of just buried in all the arcane data that you find in IRS, but it's absolutely pivotal to understand why corporate America sometimes doesn't do the right thing.
And it's ushered many American jobs out the door. It's affected wages here in the United States. So we've got so many things. We have underemployment. We have these disappearing pensions. We have all of the obligations of higher education. We've got, as you point out, retail in decline. And there are so many people who work in that service sector. It's interesting because, James, we did a podcast about the problems with retail. And I know everybody talks about the multiplier effect of jobs in manufacturing. And we know that manufacturing has really declined in America over the years. But those retail jobs really have so many multiplier effects as well that we often don't talk about. And we know that that sector is changing so dramatically. So I think people, again, rightly so, even before the coronavirus, were feeling so threatened in their own jobs. And we know that people were feeling very insecure and saying that they didn't like where they were working. I've got to ask you, can you even begin to speculate what that all looks like in the wake of the coronavirus?
Well, as you were just mentioning, one of the points of the book is that even before the virus, we had these structural problems in the economy that desperately need to be changed. And you alluded to pensions, which I could talk about in a minute if you'd like. But I don't think anybody can figure out what's going to happen, because it's obviously going to take us a long time to get back to where we were. And where we were wasn't a particularly good place.
That's
for
your
millions
point.
Of Americans.
Yeah, absolutely.
For millions of Americans. I mean, one of the few studies that we do use is the one from the New York Fed about a year and a half ago, where they did this survey and they said, if you were faced with a $400 emergency, would you have the money to pay for it? And half the country, the survey revealed that roughly almost half the country wouldn't have the money to deal with it. And I thought at the time, wow, is it really that bad? Well, it was proven to be that bad, because after the virus struck and people started losing their jobs, in 1 to 2 weeks, you'd see on TV these lines of cars and trucks all over the country coming up to food banks to get boxes of food. I mean, people are hanging on by their fingernails. If you were doing well, if somebody out there is listening there and they're doing well, or they know somebody who's doing well, they might think, well, that's not the America I know. But there is this other America out there that is just barely hanging on. And once we get beyond the virus, which is going to take a while, then I hope we will then focus on these other problems. What I'm most worried about is that so much of us will be happy to be back working that we're not going to focus on these really structural things, and the frustration over the inability to make any money, that you can't pay for your proper health care. We've seen that in the demonstrations and the protests, in addition to the pure job losses from COVID. So I'm hoping once we do get beyond that, that we can then start focusing on what we really need to do. And maybe that'll be a time for me to come back and write about this again. I don't know.
Absolutely.
I think it's going to take us a while.
You say that barring a sweeping reversal in federal policy, workers will continue to be forced to move from jobs that once paid well into minimum wage jobs that pay less. You do point that women and African Americans will continue to move into the workforce, but they will receive substandard wages, substandard pensions, if any, and substandard fringe benefits. So you do see where we continue to be headed. And you say that the growth of the middle class, or even any security for those who are in the lower middle class, has been reversed by government action. So that suggests that the only way really to stem what it is that has been a 40-year trend is to begin to change government policy. And a lot of people are talking about Medicare for all, universal basic income, even though that was frowned upon when we saw it take form, at least for 1 month in the course of this coronavirus. People didn't seem to mind. Greater earned income tax credits. What is needed to reverse the damage that you have really documented chapter and verse in your book?
Well, the probably one of the most important things that could be done, which I think would have widespread appeal, would be health care. Medicare for All, the way it was pitched, I think, created a lot of confusion, because what a lot of people who aren't on Medicare don't even realize is that if you're on Medicare, you can still have private insurance. But the way it got pitched during the campaign, it made it sound like that was out the window. But there are any kind of ways in between that where you can extend health care to other Americans. Obamacare was I can't believe what a lightning rod it was for the right wing in the United States. I mean, you've still got 25 million people out there who don't have health insurance in the U.S. I mean, Obamacare was a very, very modest but necessary step.
Well, and didn't it start as a Republican idea out of one of those think tanks?
I think that's true. And, of course, but when it's proposed by a Democrat, then that's evil, I guess, something like that. But health care is a way you could help an awful lot of American families right away. You could, this is a way that right away you can help people, not just the uninsured, but the insured. The one thing we're hearing, an awful lot of people have got insurance, but more and more costs are being shifted to them. It's not just the co-pays, surprise billings, other things that they thought were covered turned out not to be covered that once were. All of these things, what they're doing is they're making people think twice if they need a certain kind of procedure or medical assistance, because it's not going to cost them in a way it didn't used to. So that alone would be a tremendous aid, I think, to the middle class, working class people. Obviously, raising the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised in many, many years, would help a lot of folks. We also need to invest in this country. Certainly, infrastructure has been kicked around, and that's very valid because there's a great ripple effect when you do things like that. But also research, think of those things that might lead to new industries. Be a little bold in that sense. And then lastly, you mentioned student debt. Student debt is such a rock around the necks of 40 million Americans. It's $1.5 trillion, second only to mortgage debt. It's past car loans, past credit card debt. And every year, many, many Americans can't make their payments. They fall into default. There are all kinds of things we could do there, short of forgiving the whole debt, which is politically not going to happen. But you could at least put the control of that program back in the hands of the government, which it once was decades ago, and take it out of the hands of people who have made a ton of money out of it. And then lastly, I'm really worried about retirement for Americans, because the death of pensions has meant everything has shifted onto the individual, and corporations are now no longer putting up the money to help people retire. And a lot of the individual small companies just don't all have that wherewithal. But what's that mean down the line? I mean, right now, half the country, Social Security, half the people who are retired, Social Security is their only retirement check. And that hasn't been increased much, in fact, not at all for a lot of people, because Medicare costs have, in some cases, zeroed out whatever increase they got. That has to be increased. And we need to find other ways to try to build up a safety net for people. So it's a lot on the agenda. It's a lot needs to be done. It all can't be done at once. But let's start thinking about it. Let's start making some targets of things we want to do. And then let's try to stick with the plan. Because this is a terrible crisis. And I think COVID and some of the protests in the cities have shown how vulnerable millions of Americans really are, how they have been left behind, and they're angry and they're upset, not because they don't want to work, but because there isn't the opportunity to take full advantage of the American dream.
America, what went wrong? The crisis deepens, and I think many of us feel that it has deepened over the last several months. Donald Barlett and James Steele, and I'm so glad that you have revisited this material, because it is unfortunately timeless, at least over the last four decades. If anything, it is propelled over that period, and more people are feeling more anxious about America's future. But you give us some great data points, you give us some great information, wonderful storytelling, and that's why the two of you are such remarkable journalists. I thank you for being with us today on America Trends.
Well, thank you very much, Larry, for inviting me and just talking about an issue that I think is just terribly important and crucial. So I really appreciate that as well. It's been a delight to talk to you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.